back to MFA Writers. Today we've got our annual MFA applications episode. After listening to this one, be sure to check out our previous application-centric episodes with Katie Vishniak, Gregory Spatz, and Lindsay Bernal. I hope you all get a ton of help from these episodes. And if you do, I also hope you'll consider supporting the podcast by going to mfawriters.com, scrolling down a bit, and clicking the support button. Doing so will take you to buymeacoffee.com/mfawriters, where you can buy me a coffee, which is really just code for donate $5 to the pod. You can donate as many coffees as you'd like, or you can sign up to donate monthly. This podcast is very much a labor of love. We don't make much income off of it, but it does cost a bit of money to run and a lot of time. So any help will be very much appreciated. As you all know, one graduate school application costs between $50 and $100. My hope is that listening to this podcast will help you all narrow down your lists so that you aren't throwing away money applying to programs that are the wrong fit. If that's the case, and you find yourself with a little more money in your pocket, please consider throwing a few bucks our way to keep this thing going. You can find MFA Writers on Instagram and Twitter, as well as mfawriters.com. We love to hear from listeners, so feel free to shoot us a direct message on one of those platforms or an email at mfawriterspodcast@gmail.com. And if you have a minute to rate or review the show, the best place to do that is on Apple Podcasts. Doing so will help boost our podcast as we try to boost these amazing writers. Also, if you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the show, you can apply at mfawriters.com. Finally, as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to MFA Writers, the podcast where we talk to creative writing MFA students about their program, their process, and a piece they're working on. I'm your host, Jared McCormick. Today, I'm super excited to bring you all our annual applications episode. I'm even more excited to be back again with Jess Silva. Jess started their creative writing journey at Brooklyn College's MFA before eventually graduating with an MFA in fiction from Vanderbilt University. These days, they're working on their PhD in creative writing at the University of Cincinnati while continuing to serve as a moderator of the MFA Draft Facebook group. Jess, I'm so excited to talk to you again. Thanks so much for agreeing to come back.
Yeah, I'm super excited. I had so much fun last time, and I'm always down to talk MFA PhD applications. So
you're our first ever returning guest, so you will forever and always have that designation.
Nice.
I also had such a good time talking to you last time, and it was almost immediately clear, like when I was preparing for our last conversation, I was like, there is no way we're going to have enough time to talk about all the things I want to talk about with you.
I know. There's so much.
Yeah. And then we started talking about the MFA Draft Facebook page. And I was like, I have to get Jess back on the show so we can talk about this more fully. So thanks again for coming back. And I know that currently you are settling into the PhD program at the University of Cincinnati. How's that been going?
Well, it's been good. I will say, and I'll just be candid, one, because I'm always candid too, because if anyone looks it up, they'll see my complaints. I did have a huge accessibility issue when I first got here, and it's taken about 6 weeks to fix. Long story short, I moved into what was supposed to be accessible housing, and the apartment was accessible, but the building wasn't. So I couldn't actually get in and out. So it was like, what? Wait, who built this? How did this happen? I will say the University of Cincinnati did, like, you know, make it accessible and made some changes, and, you know, they put me in a hotel until the changes were made. So it's all worked out now. It's you know, everything's great now. And the English department was fantastic, has been fantastic the whole time. And basically just, you know, yelling at accessibility resources to make sure I had what I need. Right now, everything's good. I'm in my apartment. Everything's accessible. I'm focused on teaching and studying. And I'm just really now I'm really excited about my PhD. Now I'm back to being, you know, ecstatic about being here.
Well, anyone who listened to our last episode will know that we talked about advocating for your rights, especially if you're a disabled student. So I think you're setting an awesome example by advocating for yourself. And I'm glad to hear that you're getting what you need now. I know at Vanderbilt, you said they were like really supportive and provided a lot of resources. So anytime you go from one program to another, there are going to be things that are different. So in general, how's Cincinnati? I imagine that is like pretty different from Nashville, right?
Yeah, Cincinnati's a cool town. It's smaller, and I so far have only explored, you know, the area surrounding the school for the most part. But I really like it. It's got this like small city feel. Downtown is cool. I have not checked out the zoo, but I'm dying to check out the zoo because my girl Fiona is there. We share a birthday, not gonna lie. That was maybe a reason I chose Cincinnati. But it's cool. It's got a lot of just diversity. It's a very lit, happy town. Like there's a lot of cool cafes. It's the kind of place where when you walk into a cafe, at least these cafes around here, they have all those like posters for open mic nights.
Oh, and,
like,
nice.
Garage band kind of things. And it's just very indie happy. I haven't checked out all of the literary events yet, obviously, but I'm really excited too. It seems cool.
You went essentially straight from the MFA into this PhD. I mean, you just graduated from Vanderbilt's MFA. And now you're starting the PhD in Cincinnati. What made you decide to pursue the PhD right after finishing the other one? Did you feel like you had unfinished business, or were you just in the groove and you wanted to keep going?
I think part of it was that I was in the groove.
Yeah.
I do know that I tend to thrive in academia. I tend to disrupt it, but I tend to thrive. And I knew also, you know, last time we spoke about how my book will be going on submission this fall. So I completed, you know, an entire manuscript while I was at Vanderbilt. And I honestly thought to myself, you know what? Why not take another 4 years? This program is 4 years here. Why not take another 4 years and finish another book? And then I'll have two under my belt, you know? But I also realized that there's a privilege to doing that, right? Like if I had been married or if I had had kids, my choices might be different. But for me and where I am in my life right now, it just made sense. I was able to do it. I'm lucky that, you know, my PhD, the University of Cincinnati's PhD is, you know, their stipend is livable. The area is livable. The program is fantastic. Yeah, so it just seemed like the right choice for me just to keep going. I was afraid that if I took a break, I would kind of get into a lull of like, oh, I have a quote-unquote real job now. I'm making good money. How would I leave this to go back to a PhD, you know? Because, I mean, realistically, most jobs are going to earn more than a PhD stipend or a grad school stipend in general. So, yeah, so that was my big concern. I just wanted to keep it going. And not going to lie, there's a little part of me that was like, I want to be Dr. Siofa. I do. I want to be Dr. Siofa. I don't hide the fact that I'm a high school dropout. So I always say that, like, having my GED, bachelor's, MFA, and then a PhD on my wall is like, yeah, that trajectory go.
That's awesome. What would you say so far has been the difference between the MFA and the PhD, not necessarily between the schools, but just in the program, like getting an MFA versus getting a PhD?
Yeah, I think there's a certain, I don't know if rigor is the right word, but there's a lot to do in the PhD. I will say the PhD, you definitely have more literary classes to take, even if you're in a creative writing PhD, right? I'm already like looking at, you know, yep, I'm taking Shakespeare next semester. Do I love Shakespeare? I do. Do I want to study Shakespeare? But it's one of the cooler, well, to be fair, it is a class on Shakespeare and like race and queerness and all that stuff. So it sounds really cool. But there are, you know, there are literary theory and, you know, Victorian literature before the 18, you know, whatever. Like there's those kind of requirements you have to knock off. So I think that's a bit different. I don't know if I'd say the rigor is different. Vanderbilt had us read a lot. But yeah, the PhD is a ton of reading. I mean, right now, I think we're doing 2 novels a week and, you know, several pages of responses a week. I love it. It's really stretching my brain in different ways. And I think at least at University of Cincinnati, they've picked a really good cohort and we're all generous with our commentary and generous with each other. So I'm really enjoying it, but it is a lot of work. It is absolutely, you know, grad school.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, you've gone through the creative writing program application process 3 times now that I know of, twice for the MFA programs mm-hmm. and once for the PhD. So how have your priorities and strategies changed when applying from that first application to these most recent ones, you think?
Yeah, the very first time I applied, you know, I didn't cast a wide net because I didn't even really know what the heck I was doing. I had just joined Draft. I wasn't a mod yet, obviously, because I had just joined just as a user. And, you know, I just wasn't sure what I wanted to do. At the time, I wanted to stay in New York because it was my hometown. Of course, if I had known then what I know now, I wouldn't have done that because New York does not have the best MFA schools. If you want a fully funded program, they tend to be very expensive. But I wanted to stay in New York at the time. And I think I sort of tailored my applications around that. And I pretty much only applied to New York schools. I just did not cast a wide net. And I didn't apply to that many places. And it was still successful. It was a successful application. You know, I went to Brooklyn for a while. I love Brooklyn. I'm always going to, you know, hype up Brooklyn. It just wasn't for me. And then the second time I applied, I sort of had this feeling of, okay, I know my writing has improved. I know, you know, what I want my career to be, where I want to go. I think these are the schools that can get me there. And quite frankly, I think I'm good enough to get in. I think you need to have a little bit of, like, you know, not conceit, but I think you have to have a little bit of, like, confidence and tenacity, you know, when you apply to these programs. And it's like, well, if I don't get in, I'll just apply again. They're just going to have to deal with my application again. I'll just keep doing it. So I feel like I was probably more true to myself in that second application, just because I knew what I wanted. That was really when I had the novel idea. And I, you know, wrote in my SOP, this is what I want to work on. These are my goals. This is what I want to do in the future. This is why I need an MFA now, as opposed to just taking classes, which I've, you know, had done for a while. Yeah. And you know, I think the success that I had my second MFA round just really spoke to how much I had grown as a person and as a writer, and was able to just recognize what I needed and how the program would be able to meet that goal. And then when I applied to the PhD, it was like a whole different ballgame. Honestly, this is going to sound horrible. I can't even remember what pieces of fiction I applied with. I think at that point I was like, whatever. Is this my best story? Sure, why not? Let's just go with it. But what I do remember stressing about was, you know, because it's a PhD, they ask for a critical component. And I just remember thinking, have I written an English paper? Like, wait, what am I supposed to do? And I think I had to basically take something I had written probably for, like, I don't want to say basic, but yeah, like you know, a Vanderbilt class that I had written something quickly and just stretch it out. That's basically what I did. And, you know, I got into programs then and I made my decision. So they were, you know, I think as I kept applying to places, I think really just what happened was I got to know myself better. And I think when you know yourself and you know what you're looking for and you know what fits, or at least have a better idea of what might fit, I just think you tend to be more successful just because you're not just scattershot, you know, throwing everything into the wind, throwing right. spaghetti on the fridge, seeing what was sticks. So I think, I mean, at least that's what worked for me.
This program this podcast has mostly been about MFA programs and MFA applicants, but we're in our fourth season now. So we have a lot of listeners who have gone to MFA programs and are now considering PhD programs.
Yeah.
You mentioned that critical component of the application. Are there other ways in which the PhD applications were different from MFA applications that maybe our listeners would like to know about?
Yeah, I think another aspect is the SOP. For me, at least, my SOP for applying to MFAs was a bit more like, here's who I am as a writer, and here's who I am, like, here's my background, and here's why I want this art degree. It worked for me, but once I started applying to the PhD, I realized, nope, gotta be a little drier, gotta be a little like, here's, you know, here's what I've written, here's what I'm interested in, here are my research interests. Because even for a creative writing PhD, they're gonna ask you about your research interests and what, you know, what you're gonna focus on for your dissertation. You know, what are you passionate about? And for me, it was, you know, Latino literature and queer literature. And so I wrote all about that, about the liminal space of being like not from here, not from there, but also not being male or female because I'm non-binary. So like, you know, I wrote, you know, two paragraphs on that. I was like, this is what I want to do. And I, you know, I wouldn't have done that necessarily in the MFA app, but it was very much necessary, I think, for the PhD application. And also just, you know, why the PhD? I know people ask why the MFA, but I think even more, it's even more important to explain why you want the PhD. Because realistically, you don't need the PhD to teach, right? The MFA is supposed to be terminal. So I think if a school's going to invest in you, however much, you know, it is, they definitely want to know why you're taking this route. You know, and for me, it was just that I felt that I had just scratched the surface of my research. I knew that I wanted to write another novel. And yeah, and I wanted that institutional support because I wanted to be able to, you know, create a little bit of a ruckus. I needed that support. I needed that institutional support, both access to libraries and money and all that stuff to be able to do that. So.
It seems to me that depending on the MFA program, there's at least some understanding that applicants might still be trying to figure it out in some way, mm-hmm. trying to figure out their interests, what writers they want to be. But it sounds to me like maybe with PhDs and PhD applications, they want to see that you've got your interests figured out. You know what you want to focus on while you're there. And so maybe that's kind of a point that you need to hit in the application.
I think so. I mean, you know, by all means, if you get to your PhD and you change, that's fine. I think a lot of people do that once you know, narrow things down and you go, whoa, I didn't even consider this side of it. And now this side of it is what I want to study, right? That happens all the time. But I do think you have to have some idea of, yeah, what you want to research, why you need that institutional access as opposed to just considering to take more classes, you know, consider it, you know, just going on to teach and doing workshops on your own, or, you know, just going off and publishing a novel, or going off and doing like a post-MFA fellowship, right? Because some people do that. Some people do the Stegner, they do the Colgate, they do the, I'm sure there's other ones I'm missing, I'm drawing a blank, the Madison, Wisconsin one, right? There's all these like 1 year, 2 year fellowships that you can do after the MFA. But I think if you're choosing to do a PhD, it's like you have to show, yeah, there's a reason I want to do academia for another 4 or 5 years. Here's what it's going to provide to me that those other things can't.
Well, not only do you have the experience of applying to creative writing programs 3 times, you've also been a moderator of the MFA draft Facebook group for, I believe, 7 years. Is that right?
Just about, yeah.
So I really can't imagine anyone having more knowledge at this point of the creative writing application process. For those who don't know, what is that group, the Facebook draft, MFA draft Facebook group, and how can they find it?
Yeah, so MFA draft is a Facebook group for potential applicants to creative writing MFA programs and people who are currently attending, have graduated from MFA programs. It's on Facebook, and if you go to Facebook and just search MFA Draft 24, you'll find it. People always get confused by the year, but it's because we use the year that you're going to matriculate in. So if you're in MFA Draft now to start in the fall of 2024, you'd be in MFA Draft 24. Just explaining the numerical reasons. So people people always request to join like last year's group. Like people are still requesting to join 23 and I'm like, we're at 24. but yeah, it's solely a group for those two types of people. People who are applying or people who have done the process and are currently not in an administrative or decision-making capacity. We want to keep it a safe space for people who are applying. We want to make sure that, you know, faculty doesn't like jump in there and try to pitch their schools or try to sort of be like a little mole or, or like, you know, listen in like, oh, what's this, what decisions are happening? It's just for applicants and people who've been through the process. Again, we just really want to make sure it's a safe space. But other than that, you know, you can post anything. People ask, you know, if you know, my letters of recommendation are going to be late, what do I do? Or, hey, I'm considering this school. What have you heard about it? You know, and then someone who is at that school or has attended that school, graduated from that school, will pop in and be like, oh, I can tell you about XYZ, or I'm considering these three schools because I like this feel. What other schools should I add to my list? Basically, just any question that you could think of comes up in draft and the community comes together to answer. I always say this, but I have to hand it to our vets, which are what we call the people who come back and give advice after they've gotten into programs. Like they're what keeps it going, because otherwise it would be like all applicants answering questions for applicants. It wouldn't make sense. So really, like our vets are what keep it going. And, you know, I've certainly seen it all. But one of our administrators, Kenzie, has been there even longer than me as an administrator. So I think like Kenzie's the guru. But yeah, everybody who's you know, a mod or an administrator of draft is really just a labor of love. And ultimately, we just love helping people, you know, achieve their MFA dreams, because it's not a transparent process.
Mm.
So
do you remember, I assume when you were first applying to MFA programs, that first round that you were on the MFA draft Facebook group. If so, do you remember your first experiences with it?
Yeah, so it's funny. I mean, it's evolved or, you know, changed slightly just as different people have become mods and admins. And at least when I first joined, it was a little bit more, I don't want to say cutthroat, but it was a little more blunt. It was just a little more blunt. It was a bit like, you know, like, I don't know. It was just a bit more blunt. And maybe it was probably also my perception too, since I was like brand new and I was like, I don't know, what's this writing thing? But yeah, it was an interesting space, and I did learn a lot, and I met a lot of, you know, great people. I think I mentioned last time that, you know, I joined a writing group, and like we're still friends to this day. Like, you know, seven yeah, 8 years later, we still talk like every day, and we motivate each other. It's great. But yeah, I just remember being really overwhelmed, but grateful that the space existed. Because other people were asking questions I hadn't even thought of, because I was coming from a science background. I wanted to be like a scientist. So I hadn't even done any of these things. And I was like, what do you mean an SOP? What's an SOP? like standard operating procedure? That's it, right? Like, what's happening? You know? Yeah, so I had to learn all the, you know, the lingo and all the code words, the key terms, really quickly. But ultimately, it's always been just a really great, informative, supportive space. And I think we've just grown even closer over the years.
Well, as I mentioned, you've been a moderator or administrator for 7 years now. What made you want to become a moderator in the first place? And what's making you stick around after all this time?
Yeah, I'm very type A. I have my spreadsheets. I have my, you know, my notes. I just found myself coming back. Originally, I joined the group after my year, you know, just to give information on Brooklyn and like what I had learned. And then, you know, I realized that I was giving all sorts of information. Well, here's what I've learned. And, oh, you know, let me find that out for you. And I'm not someone who's afraid of making phone calls for other people. For myself, but for other people, I don't mind. So I would, you know, sometimes call up a school like, oh, you're having a problem with something? I don't know. Let me call and see what I can find out. So I started calling schools for people, calling, you know, Rutgers Newark. I swear, gets a phone call from me every year, and I've never even applied to Rutgers Newark. and yet they get a phone call from me every year. Like, okay, listen, boo boo. their website, you know, someone at Rutgers Newark hates me, I'm sure. But as I kept doing things like that, I just became so comfortable with it that. At the time, you know, Kenzie said, hey, do you just want to, like, be a mod? And I was like, yeah, sure. And, you know, from there I went and became an admin, like, the year after that or something. And I just keep going back because I love it. I love being helpful. I love seeing other people, you know, help each other. And ultimately, I like the idea of helping people get into grad school. I don't necessarily think, like, you know, college or grad school is for everybody. I don't think it's like a necessity. Plenty of writers don't get the MFA and are amazing. I don't think it's necessary. But if it's something that you want, you know, the friggin', you know, rigmarole, the obstacles they put you through shouldn't be a barrier. So if someone says, yeah, I really want to go and try this, I just don't understand what any of this means, or I just don't understand how to get a fee waiver, or what the heck, like me, what the heck is an SOP? You know, like, I love the idea of helping them out. And there's just no better feeling than seeing someone, you know, post throughout the application season, and then they do that post in March. Oh my God, I got into XYZ. It's like the best feeling in the world. And again, like, you know, now that I've been doing it for so long, some of the people that I've seen get MFAs, my God, they have books out in the world. They're faculty now. I'm like, oh, look at you, you know? So it's just a wonderful network. And I don't know, I just feel so lucky to be a part of it. It's so, I don't know, it warms my heart. So I love doing it. God help the day I ever become faculty and have to leave the group, because it'll be heartbreaking. But yeah.
You mentioned that the MFA Draft Facebook group is partially just to provide some transparency for students. I feel like I had the same impulse when I started this podcast, because when I was applying, I just felt like I didn't have a clear sense of what I was getting into. Like, the application questions were one thing, but I really felt like, okay, even if I get into a program, I don't know what it's going to be like. And so part of the reason I started this podcast was not to promote MFAs or to, like, convince people to get MFAs. It was just to provide them with more information so that they could decide on their own if this is something they want to do. It sounds like it's similar for you.
Yeah, big time. And thank God for your podcast, because I'm always like, listen to this, this episode on the school you're, you know, thinking about. But, you know, especially if, you know, like there's some people who are coming from it from a creative writing undergrad, and they've done workshops before, and, you know, they have some experience with just that writing world a little, and that in that regard, like the academic writing world, I mean, which is very different from the rest of the writing world. And so, you know, they might have the taste of what it's like. But for a lot of people, like even me, I was in school, but I came from a science background. And then you have people who are out of school who never studied writing in the first place. Maybe they, you know, studied, I don't know, economics. And then they worked in business for a while. And they're like, wow, I really want to write a novel. And I know that I need, like, this structure to do it. But yeah, but then they don't even really know what an MFA is day to day. I didn't know before I got into the MFA. Because you can ask people, but it really just varies so much by program, by person, to be fair. Because everyone has different responsibilities, different ways of writing, different ways of tackling their homework, their assignments and whatnot. But yeah, it's just, you know, draft is just, you know, one of the best ways I could be a part of to say, hey, here's what it's like. And here's a way to connect with people who are in it or have been through it, so you can get a better taste of what it's like. Because, yeah, there just is not a lot of information out there about the day to day and. You know, why you should be getting one, why you should be getting one now, what it'll actually do for your writing, what does it mean to not get one, and yeah, just what classes do you take while you're there? Like, is it just writing summer camp for 3 years? And I'm always like, no, it is graduate school, absolutely 100% graduate school. And I think people have to prepare themselves for that.
Well, 7 years as a moderator of a forum dedicated to MFA applications means 7 years of questions. And I really wanted to have you back on the show for this episode so we could talk about some of the things you've seen in the hopes that future applicants can learn from them. And we've kind of touched on this already, but one of the first questions that you said you hear a lot is, do I need to get an MFA? If I want to become a writer, do I need an MFA? And I think we both agree the answer is no. It really depends on the person, right?
Yeah. You know, if you just want to write, you absolutely don't need an MFA. I think where the MFA comes in is, you know, what kind of student are you? What kind of writing do you want to do? What kind of job do you want after? Like, do you want to teach at a university? Do you want to teach creative writing at a university? In that case, then yeah, the MFA is for you. But, you know, there are a lot of amazing writers who never, you know, got an MFA or studied writing on that level. Roxane Gay is a personal favorite of mine who never got an MFA. You know, it's not a necessity, I think. And there are a lot of people, too, who I think try to shoehorn their writing into an MFA. I'm talking specifically of people who like to write more genre-y fiction. And I'm not saying you can't write genre in an MFA. There are plenty of programs that are okay with it, you know? But yeah, I don't think the MFA is for everybody. And I don't think that's a slight or like an insult in any way to say right. that, you know? The MFA is just such a tiny sliver of anyone's writing life. And it really doesn't have to be part of everyone's writing life, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned teaching. I think it's important to know that if you do want to teach at the college level, you would need a degree like an MFA to teach creative writing. But getting an MFA doesn't mean that you're going to be able to teach at the college level, right? Because it's so hard to get those jobs now. So I've seen that kind of misconception where people think, oh, I'm going to get this and then I'm going to go teach creative writing. That's going to be my career. But it's just not that simple,
it's
unfortunately.
It's so difficult. It is so difficult. And a lot of people who do manage to get a teaching job get stuck in what I call adjunct hell, where they never really reach, you know, tenure track. They just kind of get stuck kind of cobbling, you know, a class here at this university, a class here at this community college next to the university, a class here. And there's nothing necessarily like, I'm not trying to like look down on that life. I'm just saying, you know, it's not tenure track. It's not stable. Chances are adjunct jobs are not going to come with, you know, health insurance or retirement benefits. So that's just the reality of it. I could sort of bitch about the state of academic jobs for hours because there's just a lot of issues there. Which is not to say, you know, don't try it, because I do know plenty of people who've had success and have found teaching jobs, you know, but I think just going into it realistically and understanding how difficult it is and understanding what you have to do to prepare, and also understand that honestly, you're going to have to move, boo-boo. Like, if you want an MFA and you want, you know, to teach somewhere, chances are not every single time, but chances are you're going to have to move, both for the MFA and then for the teaching job. That's just the way it is. You kind of chase academia. You find your spots where they exist.
Those jobs are just so rare at this point that if one opens up and you get it, it's hard to turn it down. If that's what you want to do, you tend to just have to go where the job is, right?
Yep. And at this point, too, and I know I'm part of the problem, but at this point, too, the MFA is not even enough in some cases. Some people now want the PhD, which is unfortunate because the MFA is supposed to be terminal. Or, you know, the MFA alone doesn't do it. They want to see a book or at least a book under contract. Yeah. So, you know, again, by me getting a creative writing PhD, I'm kind of maybe adding to the problem. but that's just the reality of it. I feel like the goalpost just keeps changing on people. And that's just something to be aware of as you enter this field.
You kind of touched on a little bit ago this reality that the MFA program, while it's awesome that you get this dedicated time to focus on writing and do a bunch of reading and workshop your work, it's still grad school, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a lot of work. I think your manuscript, you said, was like 280 pages. So that's a lot of pages to write over a 2 to 3 year period. So another thing applicants should keep in mind, it's going to be a lot of work if you do get in.
It is a lot of work. Yeah. I mean, at the end of, you know, your 2-3 years, yeah, you're supposed to have a manuscript length project done. And, you know, it doesn't have to be 280 pages. I think the minimum at Vanderbilt was probably like 175 or something. So I was a little bit of an overachiever, but it's still a lot of pages. It is still a lot of work to get together either a cohesive collection or, you know, a novel, the beginning of a novel, the first draft of a novel, or if you're a poet or a screenwriter, you know, whatever your thesis projects are. And let me tell you, I don't think one is easier than the other. It's not like the poets are like, oh, you only have to write 80. No, like they worked hard on their damn poems. Yeah. screenwriters work hard on their plays, you know, and so on and so forth. Like, or playwrights work hard on their plays. Screenwriters work hard on their films or you know, their pilots. Yeah, it's all writing. It's all hard. It's all just like sitting down, looking at the blank Word screen or Google Doc screen and going, oh God, I have to write something. Oh no, I have a deadline. And yeah, that's not even counting, yeah, the other classes you have to take. Some of which, like I said, not, you know, to be blunt, you may not be super interested in. They're just knocking off an elective or knocking off a requirement. I've liked most of the classes I've taken, or I liked all the classes I took at Vanderbilt, but that's just the reality. Sometimes you're going to be in a class and you're not going to vibe with it, but it's grad school. So
yeah,
you gotta stick to it and hope you get at least an A minus. Aim for at least an A minus.
All right. Well, speaking of that, that thesis that you write at the end of the program, you said that the minimum at Vanderbilt was like 175 pages. I think the minimum in my program was 180. I think both of those are slightly on the higher end of kind of the standard from what I can tell, just all the programs I've researched at this point. The thesis is usually between 120 and 180 pages, with 150 being pretty much the standard. So just so listeners have an idea of what they're getting into.
Yeah.
But you also, you always have the option of writing 280 pages if you want.
You can write more if you want to listen. If, I don't know if the muse hits you like it hit me. I honestly wrote like 7,000. I did. I wrote like 7,000 of those words like 2 weeks before, over one weekend of like, I don't know, man. I tasted colors. I saw sound waves. I need something to tie this all together. And I don't know where my brain went. It was mush by the end of it, but it happened. It came together.
All right. So let's say you decide that the MFA is the path for you. Then you have to decide which program is right for you. And that probably starts with deciding between full residency and low residency. For anyone who doesn't know, how would you describe the difference between those two?
Sure. So full residency is probably what most people think of as a typical college experience. You know, you would probably move to live somewhere near campus, at least in the same city. And you attend classes once a week, twice a week, whatever the school schedule is. Like I, right now at Vanderbilt, I took classes, you know, 3 times a week. So I was on actual campus three times a week. You know, and you have your workshop, usually some sort of craft class, you know, the class is varied, but that's basically what it is. Your typical college experience. Low residency is more almost of a distance learning. So what you do in most low residency programs that I've researched, looked into, you would do most of your workshopping or reading via correspondence with a professor. And your professor usually changes every semester. So, you know, the fall semester, you would have this one professor. They'd send you a list of 20 books that you would read that semester. You'd read them, email them your thoughts. They respond back. You email them some of your writing. They respond back. And then twice a year, you would go to the actual campus and spend 10 days there. And that's when you do your in-class or your in-person workshops and meet your cohort and have more of a typical college experience. Honestly, every time I see pictures of people doing their residency, it looks like so much fun. That looks like writing summer camp. Really, I mean, there are other fundamental differences too, though, because full residency programs, you know, you're on campus and whatnot, chances are you teach. And that's where your stipend comes from. You either teach or you TA, you do research. You're doing something that they're paying you for in most MFA programs. There's some exceptions, but for most of them, that's true. For low-res programs, because you're not teaching or doing anything like that, because you really just can't being, you know, off campus, being usually sometimes not even in the same state as the school, you know, they're expensive. You do pay full price for the most part. The reason why people would choose low res over full res is because, you know, sometimes you have a great job. Sometimes you have a family, you know, you're married, you have kids, you can't just pack up everybody to move to Austin to go to Michener or, you know, Michigan or, you know, whatever. And, you know, if you have the budget, yeah, you can, a way to get an MFA is to, yeah, pay, you know, for your courses, for the degree at, you know, Bennington or Goddard or Warren Wilson, which are all great schools. Yeah, and get your MFA that way. And there are, of course, I mean, you know, those schools do have some scholarships. I want to say Warren Wilson actually does have a full ride for like a poet every year, or a woman poet perhaps. So, you know, there are some scholarships, there are some different funding options. But for the most part, you are paying the hefty regular college tuition, because the upside is you can keep your day job and, you know, stay where you are. Yeah.
Yeah. If my memory serves me, the bigger low-res programs that I've interviewed students from, like Warren Wilson, for example, I think they usually have one or two fellowships that will cover the student's tuition and pay a stipend, even though they're not teaching and not on campus. But for the most part, most people in low-res programs are paying to go there. But like you said, maybe you have a job that you don't want to quit. And one thing we're going to talk about financial stuff and funding quite a bit here in a minute. But one thing that I think people don't totally think about in relation to MFAs is lost wages. So if you have to quit a job to go to an MFA program, you might be getting the tuition for free and you might be getting a pretty good stipend. But if that stipend is less than what you were making in your job, then those wages are lost, right? So essentially you're paying that difference to go to that MFA program. That's one way to look at it. So for some people going to a low-res program, they might come out better financially in the end. You don't get that totally dedicated writing time because you're also working at the same time. Yeah. But it's something to think about.
I think also, I mean, realistically, the way low-res is set up is probably the way most of us will end up writing, because I think of us, you know, unless we got some sugar daddies, and I ain't judging, but unless you got a sugar daddy, you know, you will have to, you know, carve out your writing time. You will have to sort of, you know, make it fit into the puzzle of your life, because, yeah, you will have a job, you will have family obligations and other things to take care of. So I can totally see just the benefit of just saying, well, let me just start now and doing it with the MFA, you know, where you have the support to do it in the first place, because you have a whole cohort also going through it. So
right.
Makes sense.
All right. So then let's say you decide to go the full residency route. Then you have to start thinking about funding. Some programs are fully funded. Some programs are partially funded. How would you describe the difference between those two?
Yeah, so I think it depends on, you know, where you're looking at the terminology. I know when I use fully funded and the way it's used on draft, we usually mean that the program funds everyone's tuition and pays everyone a stipend. Now, sometimes the stipends can vary by person for different reasons. Some schools have, you know, an extra little bit of money if you're historically excluded, you know, if you're from a historically excluded community, or, you know, I don't know, or, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe you're a genius and have a 4.0. I don't know. But there's different reasons why your stipend might be a little different. But for the most part, fully funded programs means everyone gets some piece of a pie there. Partially funded now can mean two things. It can mean that everyone gets a little bit of money, or that only some people get a full ride. And I think that's the confusing part. And also, I think the stress and tension that comes from partially funded programs. You know, when I, you know, did my first round, and when I went to Brooklyn, Brooklyn's a partially funded program. So I was lucky enough that I got all my tuition covered. Other people didn't. Other people got maybe a little piece or, you know, whatever. And I think it's hard to apply to those programs sometimes because you don't know where you're going to fall. You might fall in the, oh, hey, I'm going to get a full ride. Or you might fall in the, what do you mean you're only giving me $500? You know? So I think, again, that's the gamble. That's really what I'm trying to say. That's the gamble with partially funded programs. You might be one of the people that gets a knockout package and, you know, you're like, woohoo, I don't need ramen every day. and then, you know, you might be someone that's like, nope, gonna split my ramen over 2 days, you know. You just don't know. Just don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. And with those partially funded programs, you might not even know if you're going to get that funding even after you've been accepted, right? You might get that phone call. Often you'll get that phone call telling you've been accepted and they'll say, but we haven't made funding decisions yet. So then you have to wait even more time to find out whether that's a legitimate option for you. Because for some people, you might apply to partially funded programs with the thought being, if they give me funding, I'll go. And if not, I'm not going to go, right?
Yeah, but then you get that phone call and it's like a roller coaster, like, oh, I got in. Oh, I have to wait to hear about funding. It's like, whoa.
Yeah, right.
Instant drop. Yeah.
All right. So the stipend and the tuition remission, that is a huge part of funding and funding packages. But there are other things to consider, right? Including whether they're going to give you health insurance, also what fees are involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh man, fees are a big one. This goes under what do you wish every applicant knew? Ask what the fees are. Oh my gosh. There was one program I loved that, you know, I got accepted. And, you know, they gave me, I think, like an extra stipend because I'm, you know, a minority and whatnot. But then the fees were $1,400 a semester. Wow. And that's just a punch to the gut. Because a part of me was like, fees for what? I'll bring my own paper and pen. Like, what? A fee for what? You know? Yeah, there's some schools that, I mean, and it's just, you know, the school or the English department usually can't control it. It's a fee set by the school, sometimes by the state if they're a public school, you know. But yeah, absolutely ask what the fees are because those can honestly make or break an offer. And also, yeah, your health insurance, you know, do they provide vision and dental? Do they have relocation costs? That's a big one. If you're, you know, a writer from a historically excluded, you know, minority, queer, disabled, you know, community, do they have any extra funding at the university level? Because sometimes even if the English department doesn't have extra funding or the creative writing department, sometimes the university does for, you know, people from different communities. So those are all things to take into consideration and ask about. I do think I'm seeing a trend where people try to negotiate their stipend. And I think that's very tricky, especially in a post-COVID tightening up the purse strings environment that we're in now. I think, you know, some schools can have some wiggle room, especially if they're partially funded programs, and some schools really don't. And that's really not a testament to whether they want you or not. It's just so hard for so many art programs to get funding right now. It's kind of sad. And we are unfortunately seeing the shuttering of different creative writing programs and, you know, like Purdue's closed down and that's just the reality. So definitely ask, you know, advocate for yourself, ask what funds are available. I'm not saying don't do that, but understand that sometimes the answer is, I'm sorry, we just don't have anything in the coffers right now.
Yeah, it's kind of a bummer because in other graduate school programs, negotiating is a pretty common practice, right? If you get into a couple of programs, you can play them off of each other and try to get the best package possible. But it's not a particularly typical practice in MFA programs. So I'm not saying don't try it, but keep in mind that they might just close that door on you immediately.
Yeah.
Another consideration when trying to decide what program to go to is the faculty that teaches there, right? So one recommendation that I hear a lot is that applicants should read the work of the professors who are teaching there and then pick what programs they want to apply to based on the work and who they think they want to work with. What do you think about that? Do you agree with that recommendation?
No, dear God, don't do it. No, I'm always blunt. So there are some teachers that I have absolutely loved. I mean, pushed my writing in ways I have never even thought of. Made me the writer I am today. Couldn't stand their books. Could not. Wouldn't even recommend them to people. You know, like, look, hey, they wrote a book. Great. Not my thing. And then there are other people whose books I just, I would, you know, if I could take their books and put them in a t-shirt cannon and just throw them out in the I would. That's how much I love their writing. And they were some of the worst teachers I have had. Just because you know how to write doesn't mean you know how to teach writing or you know how to push a writer to get to where they want to go, not where you want them to go, which is a very big distinction. So I honestly think it's a waste of time to try to read faculty works. I just don't think it matters that much in the long run. Now, what I do think might be beneficial, especially once you get into a program, is to look up interviews with faculty. So much of the faculty that we interact with at MFA programs, they're writers. Therefore, they've done interviews about their craft, about how they approach craft, how they approach writing, how they approach teaching writing. And I think that is so much more helpful than their actual fiction. I definitely, you know, looked up some of my, you know, now former professors back when I was choosing Vanderbilt. And, you know, some of the interviews they gave, I was like, I like the way this person thinks about, you know, point of view. I like the way this person thinks about revision. Ooh, that's what I need. please come give me that lecture. And I think that, yeah, I just think that's so much more helpful than reading their fiction or poetry or, you know, whatever they write. Yeah.
I feel like one of the more stress-inducing parts of the application for a lot of people is the letters of recommendation. I remember myself being really nervous about this one because when I applied, I'd been out of school for almost 10 years and I hadn't really maintained close relationships with my professors from undergrad. I was able to reach out to a couple of professors that I was fairly close with when I was an undergrad, and they were gracious enough to write me letters of recommendation. But I also had one of my recommenders was a family friend, which I know is like really frowned upon. You're not supposed to do this. But he was a retired professor and he knew my work better than anyone else. He had read my work more than anyone had. And so, I mean, I'm outing myself a little bit here, but I had him write me a letter of recommendation, but just not mention that he was a family friend. Just mention the part where he was a college professor, you know? So I'm curious to hear what you think about navigating the letters of recommendation. What's acceptable? What's not acceptable? What should we be stressed about? What should we not be stressed about?
Yeah, letters of recommendation. Oh man, if I, you know, I don't even drink, but if I took a shot for every letter of recommendation question and draft, oh, my liver would just give up after a day. My liver would just be like, oh, are you trying to kill us? It's by far the number one most stress-inducing part of the process, I think, because it relies on other people.
Yeah.
You know, every single other part, it's on you. You know, it's your writing, it's your SOP, it's your grades, you upload your transcripts, etc. The letters of recommendation is putting your application in someone else's hands and going, please, please, God, check your calendar. Please submit this by December 15 or whatever your deadline is. What I will say, first and foremost, is, you know, most schools, most programs that I've talked to, you know, dealt with, they understand that some letters of recommendation might be late. That's just, I mean, they're professors. They know professors. Even now, like, as I teach, you know, undergrads, I'm like, oh, no, we late. Like, we have so much going on. You know, I'm in the position now where I'm starting to write letters of recommendation for my creative writing students, for their MFAs, which I'm just like, oh God, I'm in this level now. things just come up for whatever reason, especially in this pandemic environment. So what I would say is, don't stress too much about the deadline. Most schools give, officially or unofficially, give some sort of, you know, grace period of a week or two for letters of recommendation to get in. So don't stress too much about that. That's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, I hear a lot from people who have been out of school for a while. You know, I don't even remember my teachers. I don't think they remember me. I didn't have, you know, close relationships. I've been out of school 15 years. What do I do? And I always say, you know, just reach out. Reach out to anyone you might remember, you know, anyone that you, you know, they might even have an inkling of who you are. And just say, hey, I'm applying to graduate school. Here's what I've been up to. Here's what I did in your class. Remind them of who you are, you know. And you can even say, listen, you know, no pressure, but just to sort of save time. Here's my statement of purpose. Here's my resume, just so you can see what I've been up to and what I'm trying to do. Let me know, you know, if this is something you're able to do. And, you know, chances are you're going to get some positive, you know, some positive responses of people who say, oh, yeah, I vaguely remember you. And I see what you're trying to do from your SOP and your resume and whatever. Yeah, I'll write you a letter, you know. And I think that works. The other thing that pops up a lot is, who do I ask aside from, you know, what if I just really don't have professors or none of the professors are emailing me back? You know, you can ask other people. Like one person should be familiar with your writing. So I think if you know that you're not going to have anybody, especially the summer before, take a writing workshop. Take a writing workshop through Catapult, through Hugo House, through Lighthouse in Colorado. These places all offer online classes. Although, actually, I think Catapult just stopped their classes, which is a shame. But I know Hugo House and Lighthouse and all these other places offer online classes. Take a workshop, and, you know, particularly one that tends to be longer, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, you know, say, hey, I'm applying to MFA programs. Would you be willing to write me a letter? Hopefully they say yes. Most people, I believe, would say yes if they've gotten to know your writing and your classroom style and your feedback style. Just prep for that. You know, think ahead and say, hey, you know, I'm going to take these classes with the aim of getting a letter writer. But then aside from that, you know, you can use supervisors at work. You can use employees. You can use, you know, if you're a teacher, your co-teacher, or, you know, someone else who's observed you at work. People to not ask are usually family friends, if they're just family friends. Some family friends or just regular friends can absolutely evaluate you because they're in a position to. When I applied to undergrad, I had an instance where one of my letter writers disappeared on me day before deadline. And I emailed one of my friends, and, you know, this friend was an academic advisor at another school. And I was like, Mariah, I know you know other students. I know you can evaluate me compared to your students. Can you help me out? And you know what? She did. And I got into the school. So, you know, and sometimes you got to do what you got to do, boo-boo. don't ask your therapist. Don't ask your mailman. don't ask people who, you know, wouldn't be able to write you a good letter. But yeah, the only caveat is, of course, just to double and triple check the school. The only school I know of who gives me a hard time, and this is another school that probably hates me because I'm always calling them out on Twitter or is Northwestern. Northwestern requires that all three letters be from writing teachers. Now, personally, I think that's crap. Northwestern, I love you. You're making my hair gray. I'm hoping someone from Northwestern hears this and changes that policy because I think it's such a barrier. But for the most part, other schools, you know, they want one writing teacher and then the other two can be from, you know, just someone who knows you well enough can evaluate, you know, who you are as a worker of some sort or as a community member.
I think if there's one thing I could change about how I approach my applications, I would have tried to take a workshop, like you mentioned, before applying, because I was a fiction novice to a certain extent before joining the MFA program. And I learned so much in even just the first few weeks in the program. Mm-hmm. I think taking a workshop, I would have learned a lot. I would have been able to improve my writing sample. I would have been able to have a letter of recommendation from someone who knew my writing and the way I workshopped. I think it would have helped me on so many levels and gave me a better sense of what the workshop environment was going to be like when I got to the MFA. Mm-hmm. If that was the one thing that I could change, that would be it. I think so. That's something for listeners, I think, at least to consider.
Absolutely. And there are, like I said, you know, there are places out there that do, you know, scholarships and discounts and, you know, different ways to make it more affordable. But yeah, and it's also, honestly, it's also a good way to polish your portfolio, your sample. So yeah.
All right, well, let's talk about the writing sample. I think one general consensus around MFA applications is that the writing sample is the most important part of the application. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. It's king. It's, you know, I don't want to generalize every school's process, because of course I don't know every school's process, but from my understanding, most schools look at the sample first, read it, you know, kind of make a quick decision on it. And they don't even look at the rest of your, you know, your file if your sample hasn't gotten to, you know, somewhere near the top of the pile. If your writing doesn't grab them, then there's really no point. There's really no point to look at the rest of your stuff. It's not like they're going to look at someone who goes, eh, I don't know about this writing. Oh, hey, but they got a, you know, 3.8 at. No, like that's not what an MFA is, you know. So it really is the writing first and foremost.
Okay, so when putting together that portfolio of writing, what should applicants consider? Should they be trying to show like a cohesive theme throughout the stories that they include, or are there other things they should consider?
Yeah, so first and foremost, best work. Best work. And best work first. And this especially, I think, comes up with poets too. Like, what order should I put things in? Grab them by the, you know, just hook them as soon as you can, regardless of your genre. Because I think, you know, they're reading, these ad coms are reading 500, 600 applications, usually in the span of 2 or 3 weeks, because they're doing it over winter break for the most part. Not always, but, you know, and some of them do it just quickly in January. But if they're doing it not over winter break, then they're doing it while they're also teaching and doing their faculty duties. So they're reading these things really, really quickly. You want to grab them and just hold them. So that's the first thing. Always choose your strongest, best work, and especially put that on top, you know, on top of your portfolio. Make that the first piece in your portfolio. But another question I get a lot is, well, you know, I have two stories that I think are strong, but they're a little similar. So I'm going to actually take out the second one and put this one, which I don't think is so strong, but it shows my range. No, no. When you think of like great writers, you know, George Saunders and Karen Russell and Carmen Maria Machado come to mind, just because I've read them recently. They know their bag. You know, George Saunders is a little weird. Karen Russell writes a little weird about Florida. You know, like most writers have a wheelhouse, and that's okay. That's what they do well. You know, there are a lot of writers who I pick up a book, and if you had stripped the name, I would have been like, oh, I know that's Laurie Moore. That's a Laurie Moore thing, you know? So when I see applicants try to, like, diversify to the detriment of you know, quality, it breaks my heart. I just want to go, no, I want to reach through the screen and shake them and go, God, no, take it out. Because, you know, putting your best work, even if both stories happen to be about growing up in Iowa or whatever, or, you know, sailing in the Caribbean or whatever, you just want your best work, period. And so it's okay that, you know, they're in similar worlds or similar styles. Like that's almost a given in writing anyway. So definitely just pick your best pieces. And I got to say it, please stick to the word limit or the page limit. Don't try to be cute and go, well, if I just add 5 more pages, they won't mind. Yes, they do. Yes, they will. And we absolutely notice when you, I mean, just as a teacher, like I notice when people, you know, use a different font size, change the margins a little. You do not want your sample to stand out because of trickery. Just stick to standard margins, 12-point font, Times New Roman, and let the work speak for itself, you know?
If your writing sample does get you to the top of that pile where the readers start looking at other parts of your application, one of the things they're going to look at is that SOP that you mentioned earlier, which stands for Statement of Purpose. What exactly is that? And if the writing sample is the most important thing, does the statement of purpose really matter?
Good question. The statement of purpose, I think, matters insofar as it's a good way to know how the writer evaluates their own writing And also what they think of the writing community and where they see their place in the writing community. So I do think sometimes an SOP can make or break. You know, like if someone's on the cusp, I think an SOP can make or break that decision. If it's clear that the writer, you know, has no interest in being part of the community. And by that I mean, you know, realistically, when you're in a workshop, yes, you're going to get your writing workshopped. It's an amazing feeling. Well, I find it amazing. Some people find it terrifying. But, you know, if you're in a class with 8 people, that means that, you know, the other 7 times you're going to be reading someone's writing and providing what I hope is generous feedback, generous critique, insightful commentary, insightful discussion. If you're someone who's applying to an MFA to sort of like get yours and not give to anyone else, I think the AdCom is going to see right through that and they're not going to want to welcome you into their community, you know? I also think, you know, a good writer, I'm not saying you always know 100% what you're trying to fix in your writing, because if you did, why would you go to even grad school? But I do think you should have an idea of what your goals are and what you're trying to get out of an MFA and what you're trying to get out of your writing and why you think that specific MFA or the MFA in general can help you get there. I think you have to, again, because it is grad school, 100%, you have to have that sort of both the goal, but also just that sort of acknowledgement of I'm willing to put myself through, you know, 3 years of this because this is what I want to get out of it, as opposed to just doing workshops or just, you know, joining a local writing group or whatever. You should know why you want to do one versus the other, because ultimately, especially if you're applying to fully funded programs, you know, they're investing in you. You know, when I got my, I forgot which letter it was, but one of my letters from Vanderbilt was basically like, you know, this is your stipend, this is your tuition cost, this is your, you know, whatever. And basically over my 3 years of being there, Vanderbilt invested $300,000 in me, you know? You know, when you add up the tuition and the stipend and health insurance and everything else. So, I mean, you know, you are an investment in these people. And I'm not saying that that means you bow down to the institution, because these places have their problems. But you have to sort of sell yourself a little and say, hey, I'm worth this investment and here's why. And that's what the SOP is.
All right. So what are applicants supposed to think if they nail the writing sample, they nail the SOP, they got all their letters in it, they feel really good about their application, and they still don't get into a program? What should they know about how these decisions are made? And should they or should they not think of this as an indictment of their own talent?
It's so hard to, you know, give like a sweeping thing, because, you know, I'm gonna be real candid, as I have been this whole call, you know, this whole discussion. There are absolutely some people who are probably not ready for an MFA. And there are some people who are not ready and they think they are. Ooh, they think they are God's gift of talent. They think they are the next. They think they are the next Toni Morrison or something. And then you read their writing and you're like, not quite. Like, you need, you know, you've got a couple of steps to go. It doesn't mean that they're never going to get there or be amazing writers, but they're just not at the level where they're ready to absorb everything an MFA might teach them, right? And it's hard, because then, you know, some people will say, well, or those people will say, well, I was ready and I had a good portfolio and I had a good SOP. It's kind of hard to self, you know, to weigh your own stuff that way. And I think part of the problem, even when you're like amazing, is that, you know, you don't really know who else you're up against. Like, even if you're in draft or in some of these other groups, like Reddit, I think, has a, you know, grad school group, and the Grad Cafe has a group. You're not reading anybody else's writing or, you know, anything like that. So you don't know who you're up against. You might, you know, be a perfectly amazing writer, but the competition was just friggin' fierce that year, you know? I think one of the difficult things is that sometimes, you know, you get rejected And you don't know, you have no way of knowing that you might have been number 11 on the list. You know, if the school had, I don't know, if the school has 7 places, or let's say 6 places, so they let in 6 people and they have 4 on the wait list, yeah, you know, that's 10. I'm doing my math. That's 10. You might have been number 11. Someone at that table might have championed you, might have fought for you. Ultimately, you just didn't, you know, you just didn't get there for one reason or the other. And that's not an indictment of your writing. You're an amazing writer. They just felt that maybe some of the other applicants could get more out of their specific teaching style or their specific, you know, theme kind of writing or their specific program for whatever reason. And it sucks because you don't know that you were number 11, you know? You don't know that, you know, someone loved your work and you were so close. You just get that rejection letter and it's like, what's wrong with me? No, you were right there, you know?
Yeah.
Ultimately, you just have to take your licks and keep going. And that's the writing life. It really is. I mean, I know that when you get, you know, that rejection or you get that bad news, whether it's a submission, whether it's grad school, whether it's, you know, anything, it sucks. I'm not saying it doesn't suck, but it's also so much of being a writer. You kind of just have to, you know, be tenacious. You have to go, okay, this wasn't my year, or this school wasn't my school, this program wasn't my program. Let's go. And I've seen so many success stories from people who have applied a second round, have applied a third round. Even me, I had a pretty successful first round, but my second round was way better because you just know the process. Again, it's such a weird process that you're kind of fumbling along. Once you know what schools are looking for, once you, not to toot draft's horn, but once you've been in draft for like a year, you know, and you join the next year, it's like, ah, okay, I know now. I understand things a little bit better. And yeah, your application will probably be stronger just because you know what you're, you know what to expect, right? So yeah, you know, rejections are not an indictment of your writing. I think you just have to try again, you know, take a workshop over the summer, you know, start something new for your portfolio, your sample, and just get back on that horse, you know?
All right. So even after hearing all of this, if some listeners still want to apply for MFA programs, what's the timeline? When should they start doing those applications?
So I have, and this is why you should join draft. I have a timeline document that you can look at if you just join draft. But I think, you know, now is a great time to start. So what I always tell people, and I say this every year, I should just get a stamp with it so I don't have to actually say it. I could just, you know, stamp it, stamp it on my forehead. Start the boring parts of your application now. Even if you're not like 100% sure if you're going to apply to a school, it's free to start the process. You know what I mean? Like, you know, create a login, put in your name, your address, upload your unofficial transcript, you know, whatever else they ask for, fill out, you know, other things. What race are you? What's your gender? What's your sex? What's your preferred nickname? You know, those are all the boring questions that just bog you down so much. And some programs like Iowa and I believe like Texas, UT Austin, they have a two-step process and it can take 3 days, up to 3 days between creating a login and then getting to the screen where you actually upload everything. You do not want to find that out the night of the deadline. Let me tell you, there's always one person that does. And it's always like the heartbreak of draft. It's like, oh, boo-boo. Did you not see my timeline? Did you not see my post? I think every single program I've applied to, at least, lets you upload your sample and your SOP. Like, you know, you can do that the night before the deadline or the night of the deadline, whatever. So what I did was, you know, I took a weekend in October. I created logins for like 20 programs. I only ended up applying to 11, but I created for like 20, you know, just because I was considering them. Put in all my info. Then, you know, December 15 at 4 p.m., I went okay, here's the ones I'm going to apply to. Uploaded my sample, uploaded my SOP, click submit, you know? And, you know, I had all that tedious stuff already done, you know? Also, fee waivers are great to get now. If you're someone who knows, you know, you don't feel like paying, I mean, do any of us feel like paying $100 an application? No. But if you know that you might qualify because, you know, you're lower income or you did one of the, you know, one of those programs that usually gets you a fee waiver, AmeriCorps, Peace Corps, whatever. You know, look up how to get a fee waiver for that program now before they get bogged down with requests. Some schools, some programs have it right on the website. Hey, here's how to do it. Some schools don't have that program, that information anywhere, and you have to email them. But I do suggest emailing them. I was able to get a couple of fee waivers just from emailing places that didn't have information on their website. I was just like, look, I'm poor. Please get that meme. Please help me. I'm poor. And, the programs were like, yeah, sure. So definitely do that now. So, again, start your application, you know, like sign up for application portals. Get your fee waivers. Do that now. You should also start getting your letters of recommendation together. Not so much like actually getting them submitted, but knowing who you're going to ask and ask them, you know, at least, you know, say, hey, are you comfortable with it? Those are all things to get out of the way now, you know, and then spend, you know, November, early December, really refining your SOP and your sample, you know, polish it up. If you, again, kind of tooting Draft's horn here, if you join Draft, you know, there are people who get together and swap their samples, you know, just to get a second set of eyes on something. Do that. Get a trusted friend or a trusted mentor to read over your materials and give feedback. That's something, you know, that's great to do during November and, you know, the beginning of December. Hopefully at this point, you kind of have an idea of where you want to apply. Again, if you've, you know, signed up for portals, you have. Again, something else that's great to do in November is to just start narrowing it down. You know, ask people, hey, what do you think about this school? What's the vibe on this school? Start looking up the funding information and making a spreadsheet. You know, start really asking yourself difficult questions. Like, do I really want to go to Michigan in the snow? What I asked myself, and the answer was no. Do I really want to be in Phoenix, Arizona with 113? No. You know, like, start asking yourself those questions and narrowing it down. And also just, you know, knowing realistically how much money you need to survive and the cost of living of all these places, because that's important. Yeah, and hopefully, you know, by the time December 5th, I think is the first deadline I know of. So by the time December 5th, you know, comes around, you should have everything in place to be ready to hit submit.
Well, Jess, this has been just as amazing as I thought it would be. Tons of information for listeners to take in, think about. Before we go, I want to give you the last word, though. I know this can be a stressful time for people who are applying with a lot of anxiety around things going wrong. I'm sure in your time, you have seen all kinds of wacky things happen to applicants and applications. But I also imagine, for the most part, things tend to turn out okay in the end. So what words of wisdom do you have for applicants who might be feeling stressed out right now?
You know, just take a deep breath. It is not, you know, it's a process. And it is, you know, a big decision and a big important part of your life. But you are a writer no matter what. And it's true. I have seen all sorts of things. I've seen people write the wrong school name in an SOP. I've seen people send the wrong documents. I've seen people, you know, kind of freak out over not stapling pages or, you know, I think someone once forgot to put, like, their name on their sample, which I was like, I hope it's on the envelope. I don't know. You know, a whole bunch of things have happened. There was one year, I always remember, there was one year where a school sent out a whole bunch of false acceptances. That was mayhem. I've seen a whole lot of things happen. But at the end of the day, like I said, tenacity is the name of the game. And I don't even mean tenacity in applying to MFA programs over and over. I mean just tenacity of being a writer. You are a writer. If you write, you're a writer. And I think that's something that you have to sort of keep in your heart and keep that as your North Star. No matter what happens, you're an artist, you're a creator, your work is worthy of being read. And God knows, I hope to read it someday.
Jess, I hope that we get to do another one of these one day. It's been so nice talking to you again. Good luck in Cincinnati with the PhD. I have no doubt that you're going to be amazing at it. Thanks again for stopping by.
Thank you. This is amazing. I love this podcast. I will come back anytime.